What if I'm having like a stroke right now?
Or a baby. If you have a stroke, I'm gonna die soon because you're a lot healthier than I am,
Do
and
you
I haven't had a
smell
stroke
burnt
yet.
toast?
No, but I want toast. I like toast.
With almond butter?
I do like it with almond butter, yeah. I like almond butter, I like almond milk, I like almonds.
You like all men's? Whoa.
I like all people, Ethan. How about that?
Right, fair enough.
Now how do you feel, you
Not
shitty
re
human?
I don't really feel that bad about it.
Misogynistic piece of
I
shit.
just listed one group of people. I didn't say they're the only ones that matter. Relax, hey now.
I'm back.
Yes, Nicole is back. I'm your host and spiritual guide, Sean Barber. I am joined, as always, finally back, decided to make it, Ms. Nicole Jewett, our
I'm
resident expert in death, and the man who knows nothing, Mr. Ethan Black.
Yeah, it's
pretty
good.
Who has now appeared on more episodes of the Rule of Three podcast than Nicole Jewett.
I have. I feel pretty popular.
Which
pretty
I don't
important.
Buy because technically I'm in every episode because I'm in all the ads.
This week we're dealing with signature murderers, people who leave a certain calling card behind with the bodies or kill in a ritualistic manner. We'll be talking about the eyeball snatcher Charles Albright, the ADHD maniac William Harrens, and the last call killer Richard Rogers. This is going to be a long episode, fair warning. We are making up for the short episode we had last week, so you just get a little bit extra of us. That's
fine. I have a quick question. Did you know anything about this, Ethan? Did you have any idea what we were talking about this week?
No, I've barely spoken to you guys all week. I feel like I haven't
Fair
seen
enough,
anybody
yeah.
for like ever.
That's true.
I just don't think about
That's
it.
What happens
like, oh,
when
yeah.
you shut yourself in your room. After listening, follow us on Instagram at RuleOf3333 and on Facebook at The Rule of Three Podcast. We've got three signature murderers, three dumbass hosts, and no fucking clue what we're doing. This is Rule of Three. Charles Albright was born on August 10th, 1933 in Amarillo, Texas, and was adopted by Fred and Dell Albright. Dell, his adoptive mother, was a school teacher and was very strict with him, and Charles spent most of his childhood trying to please and impress his mother. Despite being strict, Dell was overprotective and very loving towards her son. She went to great lengths to make sure Charles was happy. For example, she had goats in the backyard so that he could have fresh goat milk because he didn't like cow's milk.
Which I think is whack. Like, no offense to you goat milk lovers, but there's something wrong with you.
I don't really like cow's milk either, but...
I don't either.
I
but goat's
decide
milk is,
to
like,
just
sour.
Drink water or something instead.
I just want to hang out with goats. I wouldn't even drink their milk. I'd
yeah.
be like, thanks for the goat, Mom.
To be fair, I've only ever had goat milk yogurt, and it's, like, super sour yogurt. It's not good.
Well, goats are more bitter than cows.
Of course.
They definitely are more bitter animals. Cows are just chill.
They're so docile.
But goats, like... Goats have something to prove, I feel
yeah.
like.
Well,
they,
I mean,
they,
yeah.
They've got a bit of a bit of an
a chip on their
them.
Shoulder.
They got horns. They literally fight it out by just ramming into each other and then like, all
they
right,
like
cool.
play by headbutting you too.
Yeah.
That's so
which
cool.
Which is, it's super cute.
I love
like,
it.
They're just aggressive little shits.
I'm telling you.
Dell would also buy Charles anything he wanted, including guns, which I feel like isn't too weird in Texas anyway. But
yeah, no,
still,
not really.
He was absolutely spoiled for anything that he wanted. And she educated him so well that he was able to skip two grades in school.
I forgot that she was a teacher, so
yeah.
that kind of makes sense.
So, like, yeah. how did he become a maniac?
We're about
yeah.
to get there. You
so,
just jumped the gun a
so
little.
Usually it's shitty life equals maniac lead up, but this time it seems like pretty decent setup.
But so Dell's obsessive personality, like she wanted to create the perfect son, essentially,
oh.
is what she wanted to do because she like was the adoptive mother. I don't think she could have children of her own.
Mm-hmm.
So now that she had a son, she wanted to create the perfect child. And so that resulted in her taking very good care of him, but also her obsession had a complete flip side. And when Charles would misbehave in any way that, like, Dell would decide, there was hell to pay for it.
There it is.
I just have a couple things to say, is that, first of all, there's, like, one story that Sean was really dedicated to, one that I was really dedicated to, and then one that we wrote together. This is very obviously Sean's because he loves this.
Yeah.
But I also heard another thing that was, like, a lot of, if you've heard of, like, mother-in-laws that are, like, really, like, overbearing and, like, awful towards their daughter-in-laws, like, their son's wives, a lot of the time it's because they have like those issues where they have things that they're lacking in like their romantic lives or whatever. So they raise their son to be the perfect man that they want, and then they get upset when another woman takes him away from
her. So it's like reverse Oedipus complex.
Kind of, a little bit, yeah.
So instead of son subconsciously wanting to bone mom, mom raising son kind to of, be boneable.
Yeah. To be like, yeah. Not really, it's not really like a sexual relationship. It's like they want someone to take care of them, yeah, in a way that like their romantic relationships, like they never did.
I just say
and
boneable.
So that kind of reminds
was,
me, yeah, of this, yeah, situation.
That,
where, like,
no, that's exactly what was
she
happening.
She feels inadequate, yeah, with her romantic relationship, yeah, with her husband. And so she wants her son to be the perfect man and to be everything that her husband isn't.
Yeah.
Unfortunate.
And so when it was little things too, like when Charles wouldn't go down for a nap, she would strap him to the bed. She would tie him up to the porch to keep him from wandering off. Even though, like, they lived in a neighborhood, he just wanted to go say hi to the people, like, walking on the sidewalk behind the fence and stuff. She would tie him to the porch so he couldn't go anywhere.
And this was the 30s, so kids wandering around the neighborhood
was completely normal.
Like, that's not today. We're kind of like, oh, you know, that might make sense, but not back then, yeah, at all.
That's whack.
And she would lock him in a dark room for hours as a punishment for small things, like chewing on things.
Bro, that's like normal kid shit.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Exactly.
Like,
just,
that's but she didn't want any of that. She wanted the perfect son. And any of that stuff was not being a perfect boy. That's what she wanted to create.
Joke's on her.
Yeah, really.
Unfortunate.
Can you imagine, about to take a hard left turn.
Can you imagine adopting a kid and they turn out to be a serial killer?
Yikes.
Just saying, oof. Aside from her harsh punishments, Dell also just did some kind of weird things. She would dress Charles in girls' clothing, like in dresses and stuff.
All right, that's weird. Like, why?
I feel like that's also something that is common amongst serial killers. It's like, yeah, their mother's emasculating them.
Yeah. Which is weird, because if they want to be like the perfect man, you'd think they wouldn't do that. Not that
that's
anything.
That's really true.
But like,
she obviously
from
she
then,
had a lot of fucked up things going, yeah, on in her head, obviously.
Which makes perfect sense, but it's just like from that era, where, like, there were such big distinctions between what was masculine and what was feminine.
Oh, exactly,
if,
yeah,
she wanted him to be the perfect man, boy, child, whatever the fuck, why would she flip something? Like,
yeah,
why would she,
make
him into a girl all of a sudden? Like, why, yeah, like, it doesn't really make sense.
It's, that's,
right,
like, the,
yeah,
like, not that most of it made sense, but...
Yeah. This she would the, also give, yeah, him dolls to play with, just occasionally, though. Like, it wasn't an everyday thing. And so this probably really fucked with his head of,
yeah,
who am I? Like, what, yeah, am I supposed to be? You
and
know?
This one's the weirdest one that you're about to get to.
She took him to the polio ward in a hospital and showed him all the people that were hooked up to iron lungs as some kind of deterrent or something. I don't even know.
Which I just want to say, if y'all can't get your shit together, is exactly where we're going back to, is the iron lung.
Yeah, really. From a young age, Charles loved nature and hunting. So when he got his first gun around age 10, he started hunting small animals like squirrels and rabbits, and after killing them, took an interest in taxidermy. Dell supported his passion, teaching him how to skin animals and removing their brains and shit.
Of course she knows how to do that.
Disgusting.
She's part, makes sense.
Through all of his work in taxidermy, though, Charles always left out the eyes, instead sewing black buttons in their place.
Coraline, ho!
We're, at age 13...
It's just gonna get weirder.
At age 13, Charles was arrested for petty theft and aggravated assault, and although Dell fought desperately on his behalf, he was still found guilty. This criminal streak continued. Throughout his years, he would be arrested for theft multiple times, possession of stolen goods, forging cashier's checks, sexual molestation, forgery, and altering official records. This man, he was a criminal his entire life, constantly.
I just want to say, one of those things is not like the others. Theft, forgery, molesting people,
yeah,
forgery, theft. That's a little turning. Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing is escalation. All of it, like, it, you start with something small. You see this all the time with serial killers, is you start with something small, and you keep building up.
And we're going to see it, too, a lot in the cases we're going to talk about later.
I just think it's one of the, like, I feel like it would make more sense if, like, obviously none of this shit, like, makes sense to a degree because they're crazy. But in escalation, I feel like usually with, like, violent serial killers... That doesn't make sense.
They start with a small violent act.
Like,
and
well,
then they
violent
go up.
Usually,
yeah, was killing the small animals, which is one of those three major things that can
the
point
McDonald
out.
The McDonald triad.
Yeah, so if you, it's like arson, wetting the bed at like an older, yeah, age, and killing animals. Yeah. And he was killing animals. He enjoyed killing them.
But I thought it was, I don't know, that's one of those hard things where if he was hunting, it's kind of different because he's not going to go after a big buck because he's a kid.
He specifically said he enjoyed killing the small animals.
Like, oh, okay.
He killed them for enjoyment.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never mind. That adds up a little bit
and
more.
And so, he started with the small, like, killing small animals and doing all this random theft. And, you know, we'll get into it more telling his story. But, like, he started forging documents and then forging checks and then molesting people. And then eventually we get to the murder. So you're right. It does incrementally build up like that.
It was just one of those weird things where you went through his crimes and it was
the molestation really stuck out like a sore thumb on that particular list.
Steal, hit people, steal, molesting, steal.
Kids.
I was like, hold the phone. Also, sidetrack again, I just think the term aggravated assault is one of the funniest things because what's a calm assault?
Yeah, like
a
docile assault.
Like, what do you do? Like, just to, like, is, like, who came up with aggravated? I feel like assault is good enough.
That's when a golf commentator attacks somebody. I am now going to punch you right in the fucking face.
Their demeanor about it is what makes it aggravating.
Of course.
Sorry, to continue.
So age 15 was a big year for Charles, as his life was changed forever when he lost his virginity to an older prostitute who ended up giving him crabs. And it's funny. But this tells a lot about his life.
Yeah.
So sex was a weird topic for Charles. His mother, Del, treated it very openly, telling him from a young age about sex and how to treat women. She would even tell Charles about her own sex life with her husband, telling him all the things that she thought her husband did wrong.
Again, she wants to, like, build the perfect, like, man, husband, partner, whatever. And she's literally sitting here being like, oh, yeah, this is everything that your, like, dad, I guess, or his adopted dad does wrong in the bedroom.
And so,
like,
again, she's building sex up to be this perfect, holy thing that he has to set such a high standard for. And then the first time he has sex, it's with a prostitute who gives him an STD. So that completely shatters any illusion in his mind. Like, to him, that's a failure, and that prostitute is to blame. Out of high school and spending some time in prison, Charles attended Arkansas State Teachers College, where he met a girl named Betty Nestor that he started dating. Betty worked in the president's office and had access to keys for all over the campus, which Charles was thrilled about.
Perfect.
Much to Betty's dismay, Charles used the keys to break into rooms constantly, stealing random items, and more concerningly, he would break into dorm rooms and steal photographs of girls, especially nude photos. With these photos, he would cut the eyes out and paste them onto faces of other girls. And he loved doing this with pictures of his ex-girlfriends.
This is the part I thought was weird. And, like, you have to keep in mind that this is, like, the 30s, 40s, what have you. But, like, the fact that they just have their nude photos out in enough plain sight that somebody who doesn't live in your room could just walk in and find them. Yeah. Like,
that's what I think is the funniest part, where, like, nowadays when it comes to nudes,
y'all have a safe or nothing?
You have it, or, like, you don't keep them, like, on your person, like, you don't keep them, like, into your pillowcase, like, you don't, like, under the underwear. That wouldn't stop a creep, but, like, you know, you'd think that you'd hide them a little bit better.
Yeah.
I just think it's so funny. You know, flirting with a girl, she was all, you know, you're both kind of loose people, having a fun time, oh, so
casual.
And
she, like, whips out a Polaroid
and
of her titties.
And she's like, hey, yo, check this out later. You'll enjoy it. And you're like, what the fucking, whoa, jeez. She's like, oh, cool, like, awesome.
On December 27th, 1954, Charles and Betty were married, but not long after, he was caught stealing thousands of dollars worth of equipment from the college and was immediately expelled.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't really seem to matter to Charles, though, as he simply forged his own bachelor's and master's degrees and a transcript, which, of course, had all A's on it.
Yeah.
Like, okay, come on now. If you're at least going to make it believable, like, throw in a B or two.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt. It's not going to kill you.
I just love that he made up a master's degree as well. Wasn't even good enough for a bachelor's.
Yeah.
And here's the annoying thing. He was really smart. He was incredible. Like, people were telling him to keep going on to med school and stuff like that to become a doctor because he was amazing.
Brilliant. Yeah.
If he just wasn't stealing shit all the time and stuff, then he would have absolutely passed just fine, gone on to med school probably, and been an incredible doctor. But he
maybe
didn't.
Yeah, if
but,
he didn't
but
kill
but he
people.
Didn't. Yeah.
He could have been an ophthalmologist. They're the eye people, right? Or is that oncologist?
Oncologist is cancer. I think it's optometrist that is eye doctors.
Okay.
So with these fake degrees, Charles was able to get a job teaching science at Crandall High School, which is a small town outside of Dallas. He was loved by the students and administration.
That's not good.
Up until they did some background checking on him and discovered that He had never even attended the school that he claimed to have a master's degree from.
What do you mean you hire him and then you do a background check?
This is exactly what I said, but there's a reason.
Yeah, the school was absolutely desperate for a teacher. They had been searching all summer for a high school science teacher, and he came to them like a couple days before school was going to start. And so they just took him on board and checked in on him afterwards.
That's unfortunate.
They didn't really have another choice. I thought that was kind of weird, too. I was like, well, you mean you didn't check him before, but like they kind of were in desperate times where they hired him first, checked on him later, and immediately fired him.
If it just says on your resume where you have your master's and bachelor's from, like, I'm not sure I would really question that all that much. Like, yeah, of course you have your master's and bachelor's.
I don't know. I feel like they probably do, but...
I mean, yeah, they probably, like, eventually go through and, you know, just do their due diligence to make sure. But if you need somebody to teach on Monday,
they probably just
Friday,
believe you.
You better just hire them and deal with the consequences later.
I just thought that was funny. It was like, yeah, everyone loved him. And then they checked him out and they're like, oh, shit.
So, of course, he was fired right away. Mm-hmm. And his wife left him shortly after.
Good old Betty?
Betty.
Betty Nestor.
Betty's out of there.
Aw.
He spent the next few years in and out of prison, being caught stealing random things all over town. Apparently, Charles loved to give gifts to other people, and when he didn't have the money to buy them, he had to steal them instead.
Ladies, if he wanted to, he would.
Yeah.
That's so funny. He's like a weird Robin Hood. He doesn't steal from the rich and give to the poor. He just steals and gives. He just does. No demographic. He just like
anybody.
You, there it is.
His love language is gifts.
Yeah,
that's funny.
When he was out of prison, Charles was loved around the community. His personality was just one of those that's so intoxicating, and he could just make anybody trust him.
I would feel that way if he gave me some random shit for no reason. I'd be like, oh, thanks, Charles.
His adoptive mother, Del, also did a really good job of keeping all of this stuff quiet, too. Like, she would make sure that anytime he went to court or went to prison, like, it wasn't written about in the papers or anything. And so people didn't even really know what was going on with him most of the time. She would just say, oh, he's out on a business trip or something.
She's the original helicopter mom.
She really is. She took care of so much stuff in his life. It's not even funny.
Mm-hmm.
He was an active member of the local church and was well known for his amazing tenor voice, even though he had never been trained how to sing. In 1981, though, his mother, Del, passed away, which was devastating to Charles. Later that year, Charles found himself in the worst trouble of his life.
While visiting some friends from the church, he snuck up to their 14-year-old daughter's bedroom and molested her. After he left, the girl told her parents what had happened, and Charles was brought to court over it, obviously. The trial was kept very quiet as to not embarrass the young girl, because they have certain like privacy rights if you're a minor and everything. But it was clear that there was something much darker to the kind, or seemingly kind, 51-year-old man. Charles' life behind the scenes was far from the pious, friendly man he pretended to be. After getting divorced from Betty, he started visiting prostitutes frequently, and after a few years, he was known, like, on a first-name basis by most of the local prostitutes.
I mean, you gotta get the bargains in.
Absolutely.
First-name basis for
a regular client.
Top 10 business tricks.
Absolutely. Many of these women said that Charles was gentle and caring, even giving them extra money if they needed it. But by the late 80s, he started getting more violent.
Like, he was their sugar daddy and stuff. He took care of these women. One of them was arrested and needed to pay, like, post bail, and he paid it. It was stuff like this. Like, he genuinely took care of them. All of them trusted him and stuff. Like, he was just the kind old guy who just needed to get laid every once in a while.
Reasonable. Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, but wait.
I figured there's not
going to
be...
There is something wrong with that, as a
matter
of fact.
His take on it is not going to be pretty.
One woman testified that Charles would take her to a motel room, handcuff her to the bed, and spank her violently with an extension cord, saying, "Scream, bitch, you know you like it." All right, old man.
Mama, what did you tell him?
Yes, seriously.
What wasn't Dad doing in the room? Because that's not okay.
Okay.
Why an extension cord, too? I feel like there are a lot of things
that's probably just what they had in the hotel room, I'm guessing.
It's probably a bit of a power trip, too, to just kind of use just
like
random everyday items.
Like
things
power.
That you know are going to hurt, too.
That's true.
Yeah.
I was going for a pun, but he ignored it. It's a power trip, and I was like, yeah, electricity.
The extension cord gives him power.
Yeah, that's what he had.
Ah. In 1985, he met a woman named Dixie Austin, and if that's not the most fucking Texas
Tejas.
Southern Belle name you've ever heard, no, I don't want to hear it.
That's how Texas. You know you're in the Bible Belt, is when you Dixie date a girl Austin. Named Dixie Austin.
That's true.
So the two of them started dating, and they moved in together in the Oak Cliff neighborhood, but after that, he began leeching off of her completely for everything. He didn't have a job, but he claimed to work a newspaper route in the mornings, but that was just a ruse so he could go see his prostitutes in the morning before Dixie got suspicious.
Which is a nice hustle, you know, get out in the morning, get that shit done and over with. You gotta respect the hustle.
You need
a
morning run when you can get a morning nut, like, honestly.
That's
the
awful.
The best cardio he'll ever get.
That's damn straight.
No. On December 13th, 1990, the body of a young woman was found in southern Dallas. She was nearly naked. All that was left on her was a shirt and her bra, both of which were pushed up to her neck. Her face and body were beaten badly, and there were bruises all over the place. On top of this, there was a gaping gunshot wound in her head. This scene was so gruesome that the man who found her body rushed back into his house to get a blanket to cover her with, because it was so morbid. Yeah. And this poor little man's soul, what a sweet man.
I know.
He just wanted to cover her. So sad.
He probably didn't want to look at it anymore either.
Probably not. Upon inspection by the medical examiner, it was discovered that both of her eyeballs had been removed. But this wasn't some sloppy, like, scooped them out type of situation. They were, like, perfectly removed, with
precision.
Hardly a scratch in her eye sockets.
No shocker.
The medical examiners were blown away by this. They were incredibly impressed. Like, it would have been, like, a top-level surgeon that did this. Like, perfectly taking them out.
You think
perfectly.
one of the Emmys went to the bathroom and the other one came back and was like, oh shit, like, you take the eyes out already? And they're like, I thought Jim did it. What do you mean?
What actually happened was it was a female medical examiner. She was inspecting the body, just going through everything, and then went to lift open the eyelids, you know, check eye color and everything. And she opened one, it was gone. She opened the other and just started screaming.
Oh, that's chilling.
Yeah.
Really? Like, you haven't seen worse? You're a fucking medical examiner. What, you start screaming because she's missing her eyeballs? Come on now.
That sight must just be so haunting, though.
Yeah.
To just see this body, like, yeah, you know, gunshot wound and stuff, like, pretty
typical.
That's pretty
routine.
Somebody killed
a
prostitute. Shocker. But then you just, like, get to the eyeballs, open it up, and it's just vacant. Nothing there.
Nah,
like,
dude,
that
eyes
has
are,
to be so chilling.
Eyes are too powerful for what they're worth. Like, they fucking start losing their good, like, early in your life, and they're bleh.
I'm just surprised that, like, she opened the first one and was like, oh, one eyeball missing. Totally fine. Totally chill. And then the second one's gone.
She probably wasn't chill after seeing the first one was gone.
She's probably, like, looking there and be like, oh, okay, she's a pirate. Okay, that makes sense. One eye gone? That's okay. That's not bad. But she's gonna have the other eye, right? Right. Oh, God!
The woman was actually identified as 35-year-old Mary Pratt, who worked as a prostitute in Oak Cliff. The police were staring at a dead end here, and it was clear that Mary had been killed elsewhere and dumped at this location.
Apparently, that's one of the hardest cases to be able to investigate, is like a dumped body, because you don't have anything from, like, it's not the original crime scene. There's, like, nothing there to really help you. So it's really hard to solve those, especially in this time. It's the 50s. Like, they don't exactly have modern technology to solve these cases.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And not only that, but, like, every place that body has been, every place that something criminal occurred becomes a crime scene. So where she was killed was a crime scene. The vehicle that got her there is a crime scene. So if they find all that stuff, that's just all the more stuff they have to examine.
And then anything that you find on the body, you have to question, well, where is this from? Is this from here? Is this, like, where she was transported? Is this where she originally was killed? Is this just where, like, from where she was before she got picked up?
And, like, if that place has any meaning.
There's so many questions that need to be answered that it's so hard to solve these.
Yeah, and, like, there's nothing there either. There was no, like, no remnants of a crime scene for them to even get evidence from. She's just there. The crime was registered with the FBI's Violent Crimes Apprehension Program, who tracks especially violent crimes in an effort to catch the offenders before they strike again. There were no other crimes that matched this one on record, so the police at least knew this was probably a first-time killer. 2 months later, on February 10th, 1991, the body of Susan Peterson was found on the same road as Mary Pratt. Like Mary, Susan was stripped to just a shirt and bra, was beaten, and was shot 3 times. She too was a young prostitute that worked in Oak Cliff, and just like Mary, her eyes had been removed with insane precision.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, apparently he added to it.
No need to reinvent the wheel.
He went from one shot to three.
Yeah.
Poor Mary did something wrong.
Escalation. At this point, the police knew they had a serial killer on their hands, and they warned the women of Oak Cliff to be very careful and stay off the streets. This wasn't enough, though, and a month later, on March 19th, the body of Shirley Williams was found on a curb just a block away from the Oak Cliff Elementary School.
Oh, why?
And
I was telling Nicole this earlier, but the body was, like, dumped on a curb near the elementary school, and the people who found it were kids walking to school that morning.
The first thing police did was check the eyes, and sure as shit, they weren't there. This
can
time,
can you
though,
imagine any like other murders happening that time? And you're like a police officer, you go to check
please
the
have
eyes,
eyeballs.
Like,
please have eyeballs.
Oh, thank God.
That's true. This time, though, there were some mistakes. It wasn't as perfect as it was before.
Oh, no.
There was an X-Acto blade stuck in the right eye socket, even though they couldn't get any DNA information from it. However, there was enough information coming in from other prostitutes that was starting to put a picture together for the police.
So a few different girls had stories of this old white man who would get violent with them and tried to attack a few of them, but they didn't know exactly who he was. One girl, Veronica Rodriguez, told officers that she had been taken out to a field and attacked by a man, but she was able to run to a nearby house where the man there let her in and saved her life.
Hell yeah.
The man's name was Axton Schindler, and he claimed that he knew the man who attacked Veronica, but he would not tell the police.
Why would you even say that? Now you just look guilty.
Yeah.
Like, why not just keep your mouth shut?
Another woman, Brenda White, said that she got in a car with an old white guy who tried to drive her out of town. Brenda insisted that they go to a local motel instead, but the man snapped, screaming at her, "I hate whores. I'm going to kill all you motherfucking whores." Brenda sprayed him in the face with her pepper spray and managed to escape from the car. One anonymous call placed to the police told them about a man named Charles Albright, who was close to Mary Pratt years ago and had some weird obsession with eyeballs. With this information coming together, two young officers, John Matthews and Regina Smith, went to the station and searched their records to find information on Charles.
Uh-oh.
They discovered that he had a long streak of smaller crimes, a good indication of future behavior, and a mugshot of him.
It's all coming together.
They gathered some pictures of similar-looking men and brought the pictures to Brenda White, who immediately pointed out Charles as the one who had threatened her.
Mm-hmm.
They followed up with Veronica, who brought them to the house where she went to escape her attacker. When they ran the address, they were surprised to find that Axton's house belonged to someone named Fred Albright, who was dead. They quickly made the link to Charles Albright, Fred's son. Axton didn't want to give up the man who attacked Veronica because it was his friend and landlord, Charles Albright. Veronica was brought to the police station for more questioning, and she too was able to identify Charles as the man who attacked her. Armed with this information, the police were ready to strike. In the early morning of March 22nd, 1991, they entered Charles Albright's home and took him into custody. Despite having plenty of compelling stories implicating Charles, there was still no hard evidence that could prove he was the murderer. During the trial, it seemed as if Charles was going to get away with it, until the prosecutors brought out some very controversial evidence.
They found eyeballs in the animals, didn't they? They put the people eyeballs in the animals.
They never found the eyeballs, yeah.
Oh, he ate them.
I hate to break it to you, but no.
He probably did eat them.
Damn, I thought I cracked that case wide open.
No, sorry.
Damn it.
No, this is weirdly controversial.
So
what they brought in were hair samples. Some hair samples had come back from the lab, and hair found on the bodies of the victims matched the hair samples taken from Charles' head and pubic region.
Which, hold on, let me just paint you a picture for a second, because I think this is hysterical. Imagine that you're just some casual everyday old man that happens to get brought in for questioning because they think you might have something to do with this. And of course you want to cooperate because you didn't do it. You're innocent. You're just a sweet old man trying to live your life.
Yeah.
And they say, "All right, old man, we're going to pluck out your pubes and send them to the lab."
How unfortunate it would have been if he was shaved.
That would have been
unfortunate.
Ma'am,
I would, but I got nothing for you.
You sit there until you grow some back, and then we can talk.
Oh my God.
Love it.
So we need to explain a little bit about why it was controversial. So we think today, hair samples, they're going to match the DNA and stuff. But this was still early forensics. And so they weren't extracting DNA from the hair
at all. This was years before DNA, like, for forensics even existed.
So all that they could do was look at the hairs under the microscope and kind of, like, match them up and see if they looked the same under the microscope. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to convince a jury. And so the defense did its best to just go, well, how many old men with gray hair in the world do you think there are? Why does it have to be Charles? You know, like, so they did their best to kind of tell the jury, this is just hair. Well, like, what color is your hair? What if that ends up on somebody's body? Do you want to go to prison for it? And so you can kind of see, like, it wasn't fantastic evidence on its own.
And there are, like, things that you can compare with hair, like physical matches and stuff, like the medullary cavity and the, like, the scale pattern and stuff. It's not just the color.
You have to convince
the
jury.
Layperson, they don't know that.
Exactly. Besides just finding his hair on the victims, though, there were also matches for the victim's hair in Charles's truck.
There it is.
Police also found the rain jacket that Shirley Williams was wearing the night of her murder, and Charles' hair was found on that as well. Despite this evidence, the defense did its best to discredit the forensic power of the hair, and granted, it's not as strong of a link as DNA, and honestly, nobody was sure what the verdict was going to be. When the judge announced the verdict, Charles and his defense were shocked to hear the words life sentence.
There it is.
As more information on his life came out, it seems that these killings had a strong link to his birth mother. While his adoptive mother, Dell, claimed that his birth mother was a fantastic law student, Charles stopped believing her and made up his own version of his mother. As a child, he was always afraid of being left alone, likely a result of his time in the orphanage at the beginning of his life. He must have put together that nobody who could give up a child could be a good person. So, he made his mother the worst person he could imagine, which would be a prostitute who ruined his first sexual experience, which Dell had ingrained in him as being very important and sacred.
It's all making sense.
Dude, the pieces are falling into place.
Right?
These killings were essentially an expression of his hatred for his biological mother, and if the situation of his birth had been different, maybe none of this would have happened.
Or if he didn't get crabs on his first time getting laid, he probably wouldn't kill people.
Yeah.
So let me tell you something that's going to absolutely blow your mind. So we know about, like, how he would, like, sew buttons onto his taxidermy instead of eyes, and he had a weird, he'd cut out the eyes in the nude photos and do all that weird stuff. Obviously, he had a weird thing for eyeballs. Can you take a wild guess how, remember his wife, Betty?
Yeah.
How her name is spelled? B-E-T-T. E-Y-E.
Her
it's
name
spelled
had I in it.
Bet-I.
This case literally reads like a novel.
Isn't that the best
fantastic.
Thing ever?
Who names their kid Bet-I?
Bet-I.
Well, like, what are you... I
what is it with Texas and naming people like that? There's fucking Beto O'Rourke, there's Bet-I.
I just feel like, if you're gonna say that's so dumb.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to move on to old Willie. William Herons was born on November 15th, 1928, in Evanston, Illinois, to George and Margaret Herons. His family was extremely poor and constantly fought over finances, so to escape this life of unpleasant violence, William started spending a lot of time outside of his home. Being a young kid, William got antsy and curious out on his own, but instead of throwing rocks and poking worms in the dirt like I did, he took to stealing.
Your wholesome childhood.
I had a birthday party where we had all these activities planned, and instead all of us young kids went to a dirt pile and played with the dirt.
Isn't that just the life of young boys?
Yes, it is.
No,
and that's
dude.
All William had to do. All he had to do was poke the dirt for a couple
Throw
of years.
Throw some rocks in the river or something.
But no, he wanted to steal shit.
Instead, he started his life of crime, which I guess is, you know, start him young, I suppose. I don't know.
I guess.
At age 13, he was arrested for walking around with a loaded gun. And after police inspected an abandoned storage shed that he had led them to, they found a stash of stolen goods, including weapons, furs, suits, cameras, radios, and jewelry.
That's kind of dope.
And this abandoned storage shed was on the roof of another building. It wasn't just, like, a shed. It was, like, on the roof somewhere.
Bro, dumbass, why are you leading the cops back to your base of operations?
I mean, he was 13. Yeah. He got questioned by the police.
He probably got scared.
Yeah,
and just,
of course
like,
he did.
Yeah, I know, but still. Moron.
Despite having this huge stash, William never sold any of it. Even though his family had a lot of financial problems, he didn't sell any of this stuff. He seemed to just enjoy the feeling of stealing and keeping the items.
Considering he didn't give a fuck enough to stay there, he was like, I want to leave all this shit behind. He's not going to help them out. Why would he care?
After his run-in with the law, he was sent to a school for wayward boys, but he was arrested again for theft soon after that and was sent to the St. Beatty Academy for 3 years, where he turned into an exceptional student, even getting accepted into the University of Chicago's special learning program when he was 16.
So they, like, fucked him up somehow, right? Like, I feel like...
No, it seems like while he was in school, while he had structure, he exceeded.
Oh.
But when he didn't, when he was at home, his home life wasn't good. When he was out on his own, when he didn't have structure, he just was impulsive and did whatever he wanted to do.
I feel that.
That's like kind of the nitty gritty of this, is that he is a super impulsive, like, he can't control his urges.
He should have popped an Adderall. That helped a little bit.
He surely should have.
Even though he was doing well with a full-time job and a good education, he was about to go to college. William kept stealing, and his crimes only escalated from there.
On June 5th, 1945, the body of 43-year-old Josephine Ross was found dead in her apartment with multiple stab wounds in her neck. The stab wounds were covered in adhesive tape, her head was wrapped in a dress, and her hand was clenching a group of dark hairs. Clearly, she had died in a struggle. She probably, like, grabbed somebody, like, ripped hair out.
Wait, so, like, there was tape around her neck, and then there were stabs in it? Or there were stabs and tape covering it?
It looked like there were stab wounds, and then
he had covered the wounds with the tape.
Like a Band-Aid or something.
No, that's not...
Yeah, so obviously this is one fucked up person. The apartment was covered in blood, but it had been wiped clean of any fingerprints. Like, he... You know, did his due diligence of cleaning up after himself.
Apparently not. He fucking left his hair there. Dumbass.
Yeah, that's true. On December 19th, 1945, so literally just a few months later, 32-year-old Frances Brown was also found dead in her apartment. This killing was an apparent escalation from the last, as there was a bread knife stuck all the way through her neck and a gunshot in the back of her head.
Like, the knife was here and came out like it was sticking out the back of her neck. He had... completely thrusted it all the way through her neck.
So, like, hilt here, blade all the way in the back?
Like,
oh, okay.
Like, hilt underneath her chin, blade sticking out, like, by her spine.
Homie's got arms on him.
Yeah.
So, she was found completely naked and had been washed down, and her head was wrapped in a towel. Like before, the apartment had been scrubbed clean of any evidence, but the most shocking part of the crime scene was found on the living room wall. In red lipstick, there was a message written on the wall saying, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself."
I knew it was... I knew it. He felt bad about it because he's psychotic.
Well, just wait. It gets better. Because the message was written in lipstick, Chicago police originally thought their suspect was a woman. Because, man, lipstick?
What?
No.
No, women lipstick.
I love it.
Nah, dude, that's two signs straight off the bat of remorse. Covering the face and the neck. Come on, son. Yeah.
On January 7th, 1946, 6-year-old Suzanne Degnan was found missing from her first floor bedroom. Her father, James, called the police, and when they searched the room, a ransom note was found demanding $20,000. The ransom note was all for nothing, though, as Suzanne's head was found in a sewer basin later that night. Over the next few hours, her other limbs also showed up, all severed from each other with extreme precision.
And her arms, it said, showed up months later.
Yeah, like a month later, they found it in like a different like sewer.
It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I thought you...
This murder rocked Chicago to its core, and the police were determined to solve it quickly. However, nothing turned up for months on end. They investigated a lot of leads that really just went nowhere. Yeah. But on June 26, 1946, William was going to the post office to cash in some savings bonds so he could take his girlfriend out for the evening.
He wanted to treat his lady.
And he, when we were looking, like, it was said that, like he was really popular with the girls. He had a girlfriend. He was like a normal... church-going guy
loved. Going big on her, apparently. He was cashing in, like, $1,000 saving bonds. He was gonna treat her to one hell of a night.
Oh.
Yeah. The post office was closed, though, but William still needed the money. So he decided to rob a few places nearby that he had stolen from before. But as he was making his way into one apartment, he was spotted and cornered by police officers. William had a pistol with him for some reason.
You gotta keep strap on.
And he drew it on the officers.
He said it was because he was carrying like such the expensive bonds, and like
makes
this is
sense.
During World War II. We
that
think
sense,
bonds
yeah.
today is like, eh, like old people have them, but during World War II, like, this was serious currency because the U.S. like needed people to help pay for the war effort, and so they would give you bonds in return. these things were fucking valuable. Like, yeah. People seriously invested in bonds. And so he had thousands of dollars of bonds on him. So he carried a pistol with him just in case he got mugged or anything.
That legitimately adds up.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. He wasn't carrying it for, like, any bad reason. He was legitimately carrying it just to protect himself. Yeah.
So he drew the pistol on one of the officers, but it misfired, and he ran off. The officers shot 3 rounds at him, but they all missed. An off-duty cop heard the commotion and joined in, eventually catching up with William. He grabbed a flower pot and smashed it over William's head 3 times, knocking him unconscious.
Damn!
I love it.
Police brutality who?
That's like... Jeez, man.
Yeah, just wait. That's a Bugs Bunny cartoon right there.
That really is.
Really is. But the way that they treat him just gets so much worse. William was taken to the prison hospital. When he was strapped to a bed asleep, they took his fingerprints from him.
Which is so illegal.
It is, but not only that, he's a minor at this time. He's 17 years old. So he's not even old enough to consent on his own. His parents would have to consent for him. There was a lot of excitement as police said that his prints matched a fingerprint found on the ransom note in Suzanne Degnan's room. For hours, police demanded that he confess to the murder, but the 17-year-old William had nothing to say about it.
The police needed a confession to this crime, though, so they started beating, starving, and abusing him to get him to confess.
Which is a trend with all of the other people that they brought into custody, too. Like, there was this one poor janitor who was, like, a Belgian immigrant, barely even spoke English, and they abused him so badly that he won, like, a $15,000 settlement from the state afterwards because the man didn't even speak good enough English to have written that message, and they didn't even bother to, like... check that before they beat the shit out of him.
Well, they did say they want to solve it quickly, not correctly.
Yeah. That's true.
They gave him sodium pentothal, which was called truth serum at the time. After ingesting it, William got extremely loopy and started talking about a man named George who had killed all of these people. So George is both his father's name, but it's also his own middle name. So they weren't exactly sure what he meant by that.
Does ADHD maniac have split personality?
Well, remember, he was also tripping on drugs hard.
That's true. He was tripping balls right now.
So he said he met George when he was 13, the same age that he started compulsively stealing, and that it was George who made him do all of these things.
Figured.
He also said that George would kill like a cobra when cornered.
That's a direct quote.
He claimed that he was always taking the fall for George, including the thefts, assaults, and now the murders.
I would shit my pants if it's... How old was this kid?
17.
If a 17-year-old said, yeah, I met George, he'll kill like a cobra if he's cornered, I'd be like,
Who are you?
But you're exactly right. This was a coping mechanism for him, shifting the blame onto an alter ego so that he didn't have to face what he had done.
So he had, like, his personality that was, like... The nice, respectable, church-going boy.
But George.
And then George was the problem because he also had a lot of, like, antisocial and, like, anxious tendencies. And he wanted to, like, shove all of that out of himself and into another persona that could have all the problems.
But you can't fight that forever, so it has to split itself up. No, that makes sense.
This was a good enough confession for the police, but there were still some issues with the case. The handwriting from the lipstick didn't match William's handwriting, but this isn't all too uncommon, as people with different personalities will often have different writing styles for each one.
It's crazy.
And he may have also just written it differently on purpose, so it wasn't linked to him.
Obviously, he was kind of like, I don't know, I have a little bit of an issue with this, because he was obviously cognizant enough that he could cry for help in that message.
Yeah.
But then why would he purposely alter it if he wants to get caught, you know? Yeah.
No, from what I understand, I assume that it, like, was his alter ego, George, doing that, and then, like, his actual William personality managed to escape enough of that.
To say something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
When comparing his fingerprints to ones that they had eventually found in the apartments, they were having problems getting a match. And Nicole's going to tell us about all the sciencey reasons for that.
Yeah. Uh-oh. So, it was actually... It wasn't in the apartment, it was on the ransom note, but there were prints all over it. And there was another thing, like a whole conspiracy about like a police cover-up where they couldn't find notes on it, or they couldn't find fingerprints on the note, so they sent it to the FBI, and then the FBI magically found some that matched to William. And they were like, oh my God, yes, this is perfect. So he had a loop pattern. So if you're not familiar, there are three different types of fingerprint patterns: loops, whorls, and arches. Loops are the most common pattern that 65% of the population shares. So this on its own is not nearly enough to
that doesn't do shit. Discriminatory evidence. That's not even a 50-50 chance. Yeah. Like, that doesn't prove anything.
It's like old man gray hair. It's like, okay, yeah, come on. Like, what else?
It doesn't prove anything.
What else? And not to mention, the way that you make fingerprint comparisons is you look at the two patterns next to each other and you start connecting the dots between the two of them that, like, oh, there is, you know, this little characteristic here, this characteristic here, and you match those up together. And it's not perfect because sometimes if you leave a bad print, some details could be missing. But basically, the FBI says that if you have 12 markers in comparison between the two, that's good enough to make like a sufficient match. But they only made 9 on a loop print that belongs to 65% of the population.
Not great.
So this isn't good. This is not a good comparison at all. This evidence is weak at best. Mm-hmm. And this was the best they could do.
But the Chicago PD didn't give a shit about that
because they
needed to put somebody away for this murder. Mm-hmm. And this was nationwide news.
Yeah.
This was a huge case. And so they needed to solve it. At trial, the situation seemed pretty hopeless. And although he maintained his innocence for the murder of Suzanne Degnan, he had to plead guilty to all three murders to escape the electric chair. Their goal for the trial was just to escape the death penalty. He basically, his defense thought he was guilty, and the best that they could do was try to avoid the death penalty.
He literally said during questioning, someone asked him, like, did Suzanne suffer? And he was like, I don't know, officer. I didn't kill her. And I hope that Mr. Degnan, like, keeps his other daughter safe because the man who killed her is still out there.
William was sentenced to life in prison and died on March 5th, 2012. There's more than I need to talk about, though, specifically about Suzanne Degnan, because there is a lot of stuff that does not add up. So as we mentioned before, William is a sloppy killer. He's not any trained professional. He's fucking 17 years old at this point. Yeah. His MO was clearly a knife wound to the throat and then wrapping the head in something.
That's how both of the middle-aged women were found in their apartments. Exactly like that. Very similar.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's a 6-year-old girl.
This shows,
like, that doesn't make any sense.
It shows that he's a violent and fast killer. And then he wants to disassociate his crimes from himself, hence covering the heads in towels.
Guilt.
He taped over the neck wounds and cleaned off the bodies.
Yeah.
He didn't want to, like, associate those deaths with himself. And so that just doesn't line up whatsoever with Suzanne Degnan. The murders of the other two women were also completely random and impulsive. He didn't really seem to have any clear motivation. But the death of Suzanne Degnan shares none of these traits whatsoever.
It was very obviously politically motivated, too.
For starters, she was only 6 years old, far from the middle-aged women that he had killed before. Then, there's the ransom note, which William had never done before. On top of this first ransom note, there was also another one sent to the mayor talking about how the killer had hoped to get James Degnan instead of his daughter. James Degnan was an executive at the Office of Price Administration, which controlled rationing and the price of goods during World War II. The note said specifically, Roosevelt and the OPA made their own laws, why shouldn't I? This was clearly a politically motivated killing, which William had no involvement with whatsoever. It doesn't add up. The way that Suzanne's body was cut up was done with such skill that examiners said that not even a doctor could do it. It looked like a professional meat packer had cut up her body.
Which I find really hard to believe and just kind of upsetting that meat packers are more skilled at butchering than doctors are at cutting up human bodies.
If you think about it, like, they have, like, those pig carcasses and stuff, and that's what they just do
all day
is cut, 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 cut.
Like, you mean to tell me that a doctor can't do better than a butcher? Then why aren't butchers our doctors, huh?
Well, it also makes sense that the way her body was cut up.
That's true. It was hacked into, like, pieces.
The limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't anything, like, surgical,
meticulous.
Really. It wasn't, like, cutting out the eyes.
Yeah.
It was just removing the limbs, which is exactly what a meat packer
cut up all those bodies.
Also, the key point that I think you might have missed there is doctors typically do things on living people.
That's true.
Meat packers cut up carcasses. There's a defining line.
That's a good point.
And at the time, the Meat Packers Union was on strike nationwide and specifically had issues with the OPA, who was rationing their dairy products. In fact, another OPA executive in Chicago had received similar threats. So the murder had nothing to do with William. But because the police were desperate to solve the case, they just pinned it on the first person that came along.
And this is just our interpretation, but it seems pretty damn good.
Even just from reading this, like, it's so obvious this was not him. I don't know who it was, but Suzanne Degnan was not killed by William. This isn't to say that he's an innocent person. He's not.
No.
He killed those other two women. He totally killed Josephine and Frances. But he is not guilty for the murder of Suzanne Degnan.
That's just, like you said, that's way too much of a jump and like difference in a lot of things, like MMO. Like, if he was so, you'd think that if there's such a pulling aspect of remorse or like dissociation with it,
he was very remorseful,
then why would he literally carve up a 6-year-old girl and then leave their body parts around? You would think that if he was gonna do it, it'd be like, oh shit, like, let me hide all this because, like, I ain't about this life. Like, why would he put them on display for some reason? Like, that's not...
Yeah, absolutely. And demand money? Like, he wouldn't even sell his stolen goods to help his family. Like, why did he need $20,000?
Like, that's crazy.
But there was also something with, like, there was a shit ton of other suspects in this case. Like, a bunch. I don't know why they pointed the finger at William, because, to me, he was not the most, like, closely associated. Yes, with Josephine and Frances, but not with Suzanne at all.
Yeah.
And there was one guy who, like, they found his handkerchief outside of where Suzanne lived, just in, like, a back alley somewhere next to, like, a wire that they thought maybe he might have, like, strangled her with. And so they looked him up, and they found out that this guy lived in New York and was out of the country at the time, and he has no fucking clue how his handkerchief ended up in Chicago. What? That makes no sense.
It's so clear. Like, months had gone by since she was killed by the time that he was in prison. So obviously their standards had just been getting lower and lower and lower for what they would consider good enough.
Yeah.
And so by the time they had this guy come in confessing to other murders, they just went, yep, that's our guy. And the print that they found on the ransom note was, like, oddly clean. Usually when you find a fingerprint on just some evidence, it's really muddy. Like, you can only get certain, like, it's not clear. It's not a perfect print. But this one was very, very clean. Like, there were a couple parts missing, but that was suspiciously clean.
So, like, frame
and
job.
Not only that, but it looked like it was rolled. You know how, like, when they book people, they roll your prints?
To get all of it.
Yeah, get the sides and everything. Because sometimes you can, like, touch something with the side of your finger.
I've been fingerprinted before. It was the weirdest experience of my life.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
It is really odd.
But, like, it looked like a rolled print, like they teach you to do at the police academy. So they were like, okay, yeah, that was not a coincidence. And how they, like, couldn't find anything, and then all of a sudden the FBI was like, oh, but we found something. Like, really?
No, it's just, that's...
Well, I mean,
that's foul.
What it seems like the government just wanted to shut down this strike however they needed to. I mean, this, like, we think of, like, oh, strikes now aren't really a big deal, but unions and striking could shut down the entire country.
Yeah.
And this was during the war. Like, they needed to resolve it, and they needed to resolve it now.
Yeah.
And so if they had to lock up some person who had already killed two other people, then fuck it, do it.
Good they enough. Also created a huge media frenzy around this, because obviously they were trying to distract from the strike and everything to make a whole different thing. So he started, like, mumbling about George when he was, like, absolutely fucking off his rocker.
Ripping nutsacks.
And so he starts mumbling about this George. And so the psychiatrists who were, like, evaluating him started writing down that he was writing George and then mumbled a last name, or murmured a last name is what they said. And so then they, like, the investigators went and convoluted that into George Merman was his name. And then the media took that and started calling him Murder Man. And that's what they created. Like, they spun up a huge frenzy about it.
Which is so fucking dumb, but I mean...
Oh yeah,
I
mean, absolutely ridiculous.
It's 1940s reporting.
You gotta do something.
Expect too much from it.
You gotta do something to make a buck.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we have Richard Rodgers.
Richard Rodgers was born in 1950 in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and moved with his family to Florida in his early teens. Richard's family was nothing special at all. He was the oldest of five children, and both his parents were just average working-class adults. He seemed to cruise just fine through school and attended college to start his journey into the field of medicine. After graduating college in Florida, Richard went all the way up the East Coast to Maine, where he attended the University of Maine to get his graduate degree in French, of all
things. Let's go, Black Bear!
That's always an unfortunate move. Moving to Maine, you're done after that.
Fuck you.
Well, starting in Maine is different. Moving to Maine, you're done.
That's when you call it quits. That's like reverse retirement. You know how everybody goes to Florida to be happy? You move to Maine to be miserable.
You move to Maine to be able...
So many people retire to Maine.
Well, that's because they're serial killers.
Because they want to live in the woods by themselves.
Yeah,
that's why.
Freaks.
Because you're not going to find a body in the woods if, you build a log cabin on top of it. That's going to be
the birthplace of Stephen King is where all the normal people go, I'm sure.
He's from Maine?
Sure. Yeah.
Yes. That makes fucking
sense.
He's
like Maine's pride and joy. He's one of the only famous people from Maine.
He's the Maine psychopath.
So is Anna Kendrick.
Anna Kendrick?
Yeah.
Wait, is it Kendrick's or Kendrick?
Kendrick.
Yeah.
The one from Pitch Perfect?
It's just one of them.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
Yeah, she's from Maine.
That was funny. None of you laugh. Fuck
I'm sorry, what did
you say?
I said there's only one of them, because he said Anna Kendrick's.
Oh.
Whatever.
I didn't hear it.
No,
anyway.
I was genuinely being curious if it was the right person.
I'm just, surprised that he got a graduate degree in French. Or at least he tried. Maybe that's what he went all the way up there for.
La France is a romantic language.
That was awful.
Bonjour.
Well, my brain got caught with romance and romantic, so I just kind of had a stroke in my throat.
While in grad school, Richard lived in the same apartment building as a man named Frederick Spencer, and Richard found himself in a little bit of trouble with the law in 1973 after a dispute between the two of them got physical.
Oh, no.
Richard says that he found Frederick in his apartment snooping through his stuff, and with a hammer in hand, he charged at Richard, causing him to seize the hammer and hit Frederick 8 times in the head to defend himself.
I feel like 3 times
is sufficient.
Then again, homie might have had a hard dome, so
maybe,
I guess
8 times.
Maybe he did.
Maybe on the 8th time he heard a crack, and he was like, that's the one.
That'll do.
He was a doctor, or he was like, what, starting to be a doctor?
I think he got his undergrad in nursing, graduate degree in French for some reason.
So you know, like, anatomy, so you're like, all right, he can take 7 shots of the dome and be fine. And then he was like, we'll do it 1 just for luck. It's kind of
good measure.
Like
that
birthday punches.
Is officially medically toast.
He drove Frederick's body to a secluded area of woods on the side of the road. And remember, we're in northern Maine, so that's just about everywhere.
Everywhere is the middle of the woods.
literally everywhere. And dumped his body there. Not long after, 2 bicyclists came across Frederick's body just outside of Old Town, which, if you know about, like, Old Town canoes...
No.
That's where they're from.
Who? So you could say that they found his body on the Old Town Road.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. But you are proving my point. He drove to a road and dumped a body in Maine. If somebody did that in Philly, that'd be, like... Too quick.
It was a very rural, secluded road. I'm not saying it was just every road.
No, I know, but I'm just saying that you're proving my point that Maine is for psychopaths.
Okay, fair enough. Richard was put on trial shortly after, but his self-defense story held up, and he was acquitted of manslaughter in Penobscot County Superior Court, managing to get away with only 6 months of jail time.
All right, wait, I'm going to enter it one more time, because I'm still not getting the part where you hide a body in self-defense?
Yeah, that's the part I was a little bit weird at. Like, sure, fine. He attacked you and you fought back and accidentally killed him. Like,
8
whatever.
Hammers, yeah,
but you dumped his body. I mean, I guess you could make an argument that he panicked, but come on now.
But I still would feel like obviously, panic is a thing, but I feel like you'd freak out and then you, I don't know, like,
and
I feel like
if, the disco.
If I knew I was gonna, or if I knew I, beat someone to death with a hammer, I caved their skull in, but I was I had to do it, and, I was kind of making myself feel okay about it, my first instinct, I don't think, would be, I gotta hide this bitch and pretend it didn't happen. I'd be, got assault, I don't know. I always think about when you're hiding a body, it's kind of like when you break something and you hide it.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to get caught, and you're you did that, you stupid prick. I feel like if you want to call self-defense, you gotta be a little more convincing. Then I hammered him in the skull, and then I dumped him on the side of the road like some poop.
One time, I was playing with my sister in the house, and we were just tossing a ball around, which my mom told us repeatedly, don't do that, don't throw balls in the house. I did anyway, and ended up hitting a picture frame thing. It fell and broke, cracked right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So my genius idea to appear innocent and relieve myself of the crime was to use clear tape over the crack, which, of course, doesn't mask the fact that there's a crack on it because it's fucking clear. So, yeah, he was guilty. Anyway.
Oh, my God. I feel like when I was younger, my mom would always be like, be careful with that. It's fragile. Don't break it. And, like, seconds later, I would drop it and break
smashed it. Smashed to pieces.
It's always when you point it out. At this point, Richard had a reputation as a violent outcast in a very small community, so he decided to switch gears and go somewhere where he would be much more likely to blend in.
In New York!
That's right. We're back, baby.
Yeah, baby!
He went to the Big Apple.
That's the second move, yeah.
Here he attended nursing school in the late 70s and got a job at Mount Sinai Medical Center, where he would continue to work for 22 years. He was actually quite successful with his career here, moving on to become a surgical nurse and then working in the pediatric ward treating children with heart conditions. So he wasn't altogether a bad guy.
Yeah, except for the murder parts.
Yeah. Despite his fulfilling career and his reputation as a friendly neighbor, Richard didn't manage to stay out of trouble for long. In 1988, the NYPD would have their first run-in with Richard after he was accused of drugging a man, tying him up in his apartment, and sexually assaulting him.
That's not great.
Nope. Self-defense.
No.
I had to, officer.
That's awful. Surprisingly, Richard was off the hook once again after he was acquitted in a non-jury trial later that year. It was around this time that Richard's violence began to escalate, and he started hanging out at the townhouse bar that was well known for its gay male clientele, and it is widely speculated that Richard was a closeted gay man himself.
He was so straight that he went to the gay bar. That's how straight this man was.
That's, I mean,
like,
obviously.
I think, and like, I guess during his trial, he did say, like, he said as much as that I'm gay or whatever. He kind of admitted to it. But to me, it kind of seemed like he was so uncomfortable with his own sexuality. Like, he didn't accept himself like that.
He needed to take it out on
others.
Yeah,
so you kill gay people. Started taking it out on other people.
Yeah, I feel like that's a, well, all right, I don't want to say normal thing to do. But I feel like
that's a thing that happens, yes.
Unfortunately, typical way to, like, get out stress is to, like, take it out on things that you don't like.
Yeah. Richard would frequent the bar and take heavily intoxicated men home at the end of the night, only for their remains to be found days later, earning himself the nickname The Last Call Killer.
In 1991, an investment banker from Philadelphia, Peter Anderson, was attending a political fundraiser in Manhattan. He had recently ended his marriage after coming out as gay, and he was last seen staggering out of his hotel to go down to the townhouse. I like how he had to stagger out drunk to go to the bar. Very
bro,
nice,
you
Peter.
Have to. That's what, that was my favorite thing about that. Is like, yeah, he was seen staggering out. So homie pre-gamed way too much, and then was like, let me go to a bar because that's a good idea.
He was, listen, he was, he knew like the Philadelphia scene. He was not prepared for the Manhattan gay scene, though, apparently.
I guess
holy
not.
Shit.
Or at least he was over-prepared.
He was just so nervous, he just got drunk, and he's like, all right. Now I'm good.
Now I'm ready.
A few days later, Peter's remains were found in a garbage bag at two different rest stops along the Pennsylvania Turnpike, with gaping wounds throughout his body and a severed penis in his mouth.
Yep. His own was in his mouth. Which, honestly, though, I have to say, kudos to the killer for taking him back to his home state and dumping him there.
Yeah, that's very nice of him, yes.
No, that's not nice of him. That's smart as fuck. Like, who would know he got murdered in New York? If he's from Pennsylvania and he went right back.
Well, I mean, he was last seen in New York, so that would probably do it.
Yeah, but I don't know. Still, it takes a little bit of blame
does,
off the people in New York.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you, and he does, he dumps these bodies all over the place, and so that makes it a lot harder to make the connections.
Yeah.
In July 1992, Thomas Mulcahy was in Manhattan for business as a computer sales representative. He had a wife and kids at home in Massachusetts, but was known to have affairs with men throughout the course of his marriage.
Mm-hmm.
On July 8th, Thomas was seen leaving the townhouse bar with an average-looking stranger and was not seen again until his dismembered body was found in trash bags at two highway rest stops in New Jersey.
What the hell is an average-looking stranger?
That's
Richard.
Okay, that's the thing I was going to say was, like, everyone who commented on Richard, like, the townhouse was a piano bar, and so I guess he hung out at the piano, and so later the piano player was interviewed and, like, asked about him, and he was like, he was dull, average looking, like a completely forgettable person. And he's like, honestly, the only reason I knew him was because he hung out at the piano.
He's not very good at being gay if he's that dull that he sits by the piano all night. Like, come on, man, have a little bit of fun.
Well, apparently he is because he's taking bitches home every night. He's getting, he's giving the pipe out to the millions.
Wrong, I guess
he's got some magic.
After his autopsy, the medical examiner ruled that Thomas had died from multiple stab wounds to his abdomen. Less than a year later, in 1993, a 44-year-old sex worker named Anthony Marrero was also found stabbed several times and discarded in a series of trash bags dumped along a road in New Jersey.
It was never one trash bag, and it was never one site. He would always put them in different bags and dump them at different places along the same stretch of highway.
Which, as gross and awful as that is, that's a good fucking strategy.
But yeah. It's smart, except for the fact that he consistently does that. That's how people link together serial killers, is they repeatedly
do the same thing.
That's true.
And that's how it's so easy to catch people that have signatures. And signatures are actually allowed to be used in court as evidence.
Yeah.
Like, that's
yeah.
real evidence, is somebody has a signature that they use.
Yeah.
And so by doing this, yes, it's smart that you're dumping these bodies in trash bags all over the place, but that also lets police clearly know this is a serial killer, this is one person that's doing it.
Yeah.
It doesn't help that you're spreading out the bodies so much, because that still is linking it to one person.
Yeah.
And all you really have to do after that is find the central location.
Yeah.
And if you look at it on a map, all these dumping sites, like, form a ring around Manhattan.
Yeah.
So it's clever.
And all of the people were
clever.
Last seen at that one bar.
Yeah. So, like, it's smart, but also kind of fucks himself over in the process.
Yeah.
Finally, the remains of Michael Sequeira, a 56-year-old typesetter from New York, were found just the same as all the others in trash bags at a rest stop in Rockland County, New York. Michael was openly gay and was last seen getting into a car with a strange man after leaving the townhouse bar just days before.
Of average description?
Yes, an average man.
Average height and build?
There's speculation that Richard might be to blame for the killing of Matthew Piero in Florida back in 1982, which happens to coincide when he was visiting Florida to attend his high school reunion, but this linkage is very loose. There is little evidence found to link anyone to these crimes, though it was almost certain they were connected, and a surgical saw blade and gloves that were found with Thomas Mulcahy's body was the extent of the forensic evidence in this case. The joint task force, composed of all the jurisdictions where the bodies were found, managed to trace the items back to a couple of stores in Staten Island, but after that, the case went cold until 1999. It was then that Thomas Mulcahy's wife, Margaret, pushed the New Jersey State Police to re-examine the case, since there had been many advances in forensic science since the early 90s that could shed some light on her husband's murder. This prompted the task force to send the trash bags away to the Toronto Police Department, who had just begun using brand new fingerprint technology called vacuum metal deposition, or VMD, to try and lift prints off the bags.
DMV.
So VMD works by coating the surface of the fingerprints in a super thin metal sheet under high vacuum conditions, which causes the metal to coat the substrate underneath the print. So it doesn't stick to the oils itself, it sticks to everything but. So it creates a reverse developed latent print. This technique is known for its use on difficult substrates to get prints from, just like a slippery plastic garbage bag. So this is like brand new, like cutting edge at the time. Now we use like different chemical fumings to get mm-hmm. things like that. But this is like brand spanking new.
Hot off the presses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is like the fact that they had to send it away to Toronto to even get it done. Like they were one of the only.
Doing it anywhere locally.
Yeah, they were one of the only police departments who had the technology to do it at all.
Good old Canada.
Canada.
Oh, Canada.
The Mounties. Sure know how to catch fingerprints.
They'll get them.
The fingerprinting was a success, and in 2000, the New Jersey State Police sent the prints along with a description of the case out to every state police department in the country, hoping to find a match. Today, we know that the FBI maintains databases of multiple things that could be used for identification in a crime. There's, you know, DNA databases, automobile print databases, mm-hmm. Weapons databases, all that kind of stuff. But one of them is the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, known as AFIS. However, this database was brand new in 1999, and not every state was participating in the sharing of information yet. Even today, AFIS is only as good as the number of prints that it already contains, since it's only the way, like, matches are made. Like, that's it. So if you don't have, and obviously it's unconstitutional for us to require every single person living in this country to put their prints into a database like this.
So it's only people that have already been booked.
Like, repeat offenders, yeah.
That their prints are even in there. So if you're looking for a new offender, they're not in there.
Oh, exactly. So my prints aren't in AFIS?
Probably not. I mean, you said you've been fingerprinted before, but probably not by anyone who would have put it in that database. Yeah.
I don't think so, unless UPS has some beef with me.
Maybe, actually, because, like, government government.
Remember the fucking postal investigators?
Like
they fucking hunt people down.
You might be in it.
Yes, I'm an aphid.
I'm not sure though.
Dude, the UPS is not fuck around.
Don't
man.
Worry. If I ever
postal
get,
crimes.
If I ever lose my fucking marbles and go off the rails, and I'm
interrogated, they're gonna catch
you. I'm gonna tell them. Be like, check my ass out. I'll be in aphid section like 2892, officer. I'll give you the password.
Nice. So at this point, you know, we've got a national database going, but it was brand new. And so each state kind of had their own index of arrestee fingerprints that they use to catch repeat offenders, you know, with their own jurisdiction.
Arrestee.
And this is also like right at the advent of the internet. So a lot of these were like physical fingerprinting cards. So at this point, they were probably just now starting to put their own state's databases into like an online type of thing. So that was all they had. They didn't have the time and effort to then submit it to the national government. Like, that was just it.
It was really janky at this point. Like, there was no way for somebody in, like, Pennsylvania to be fingerprint ID'd for a crime in, like, Vermont or something.
Yeah.
And so all these crimes being committed in New York, you weren't going to get, like, any matches in, like, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where he dumped a lot of these bodies.
Which is exactly why the New Jersey Police Department made it a point to send that evidence out to everybody and say, hey, can you check your databases for this?
Yeah.
Despite not getting a hit linking the crimes to a specific individual just yet, New Jersey State Police were able to match the prints found with Thomas Mulcahy's body and those found with Anthony Marrero's remains at least, proving for sure that the same individual committed both of those crimes. In 2001, a call came back from the Maine State Police saying that they had a match to the fingerprints found on the trash bag. When Richard had murdered his roommate back in 1973 at the University of Maine, his fingerprints were taken and left on file all this time, and finally the technology had come around to connect his prints to these crimes.
So this is exactly what happened. Like, Maine was working on their own database. They hadn't submitted all of their information to the FBI's database yet. So when they got them, they were like, oh, ding, we have a hit. And that's where it came from.
Hammer time is now, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep.
Shit's coming back with a vengeance.
Richard was arrested by the NYPD at Mount Sinai Hospital on May 28, 2001. And when they searched his home on Staten Island, they found a bottle of Versed, a common date rape drug, rug fibers that match those found on Thomas Mulcahy's body, and several photos of unknown men who had stab wounds all over them. He was extradited to New Jersey, and in 2005, he was put on trial for the murders of Thomas Mulcahy and Anthony Marrero, the two whose bodies were found in New Jersey, and he was offered a plea deal to only serve 15 years for each count. However, he maintained his innocence and was sentenced to 30 years to life on both counts.
So he was never actually held responsible for any of the other killings, and even though, if you ask me, it was definitely him,
it's
because it was absolutely, like, all of the details were completely similar, but they couldn't really prove it. And at this point, like, he's in New Jersey. They were just going to prosecute him for the crimes that, like, occurred in New Jersey, as far as they knew. Yeah. So that was as good as it got.
That's
so at
crazy.
Least he got behind bars, but he wasn't actually connected to any of the other people.
He was caught when I was five.
That happens for a lot of these cases, too, actually, especially serial killings, when there's so many victims. But if you can, all you have to do is prove one.
And if you have any that are weak, you leave them out.
At trial, you have to prove guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But if you can just prove one really strong case, that's all you need to do to get them locked away for life.
Dominoes.
And if you, like, insinuate to the jury that, yes, he's also responsible for all these other ones,
but you don't have a good reason,
then the jury is, like, automatically going to want to, like, sentence them to the harshest punishment available.
Yeah.
And for any case of murder, that's life.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's kind of what the goal is behind.
Well, I'd say the harshest
trials.
Punishment is probably death.
Incorrect, I'd
well,
say.
Well, no, for a lot of states,
that's true.
Don't have the death penalty
that's
anymore.
True.
So they want to seek the highest possible charge that they can for them. So if you can just prove one murder, then that's the same sentence in essence as, you know, 20 murders. All of them are a life sentence.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you want to make sure you get that one. So Richard is currently 70 and is serving time in the New Jersey State Prison, spending his days happily watching the news, writing letters, and enjoying the prison kitchen's roast beef. That's good, I guess.
That's what he said. It was his favorite. He loved
the roast
beef from the prison kitchen. Yeah,
I love the roast beef from Sodexo. Maybe they work together.
Doesn't Sodexo do a lot of the food
for prisons?
I think so, actually.
They do, don't they? Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to look that up and confirm that. And by we, I mean you guys, because y'all are the looker-uppers.
That's nice. Richard and us enjoy the same roast beef.
The same cuisine.
Yeah, awesome. That's
probably
nice.
From the same region,
it.
Too.
Yeah.
The roast beef here does slap.
Anyway, that's all that we've got for you this week. Thank you for sticking around for this very long episode. We made it together. We did it. I hope you guys enjoyed it, though. These stories
really
had me invested. All of these stories, I just feel like... are really gripping. You know, I don't know what it is about.
Oh, yeah, they had me right up to the very end. Every detail was just so good.
And I found myself being mad that William was, like, framed for this crime, even though he's a convicted
murderer. He still
murderer.
Was a horrible murderer.
Yeah, but that's one of the hardest things with cases of multiple personalities, because, like, yes, they're the same person, but they're also not.
Yeah.
Because it's hard
he
to...
He did feel very bad about it.
Yeah.
But
you feel
he still
bad
did
for
it.
William, but he still did it. Yeah. Like, the fact of the matter is that was the same person, the way that we understand.
Which, fine, put him away. Good. But, like,
you
can't help but feel a little
get
sorry
him some
for
help,
him.
Yeah.
I don't think that he killed Susie.
No, he absolutely
No, absolutely
didn't.
Not.
No, no
like,
chance.
There's
no
gotta
chance.
Be no, and I'm no scientist or whatever, but, like, there's... You gotta have some standards, and that shit, like, didn't line up at all.
Yeah.
That was, like, triangle going into a rhombus shape. Like, that shit just doesn't fit at all.
Yeah. Anyway, we're gonna wrap this up. It's been a very long one. Go follow us over on Instagram at Rule of 3333. Find us on Facebook at the Rule of 3 Podcast, and we will see you next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.